And you're very welcome to the Bread and Butter podcast. We are, of course, recording our next series of 2023 and delighted to be bringing you these podcasts, not only on audio, but on video as well. We will be popping them up on YouTube. Delighted to be bringing you Oran Coyle. Oran, hello, you're very welcome to the Bread and Butter podcast. First of all, for anyone that doesn't know you, please do inform them who you are and where you're from, Oran.
Hello there, dead on for having me, by the way. Name's Oran. I'm a financial planner here based in Derry, Northern Ireland, covering the UK. Young man, motivated. I'm looking forward to getting to meet new people, talking to people, chatting about business, but mainly I'm a financial planner, and that's my day-to-day. And obviously, as you know, I spend part of my day-to-day making content online so people can understand more about money and finance and investing and things like that. And simple things, really. So dead on for having me. I really appreciate the part, too.
You're very welcome, Oran. Thanks for joining us. I suppose the Bread and Butter podcast is about having a chat with people who are out there, putting themselves out there and really in the entrepreneurial world and trying to get a message out there. And suppose, Oran, that's something why we brought you on the program, just to have a chat to you about that. And suppose you've making the fun out of financial terms and really pushing that, I suppose, with your content and your Instagram and your TikTok and all that as well. But we will get into that, Oran. I suppose, first of all, tell us a wee bit about yourself. I know you indicated you're from Derry, but I suppose life didn't always start as a financial advisor for you.
No, definitely not. I obviously grew up like everybody else grew up here, went to school, worked hard to get good grades, and eventually, when I was 17 or 18, you know, when you get sort of pressed to figure out what you really want to do, I had sort of always had that idea that I wanted to deal with money in some way or form, like accountancy or finance or banking or something like that. And eventually, I settled on doing accountancy for an undergraduate degree. And looking back, it actually has served me really well in terms of what I do now. But coming from when I was younger, studied my degree in accountancy. And at the end of that, I figured, you know, accountancy is a good place to be, but is it the place for me? And then I decided, maybe should I go on and do something else? And done a bit of searching. And I actually had applied to do a master's degree in quantitative trading and analysis at Queen's, which would have took me down the, you know, the investment banking or the quant trading route for some of the big banks. But at the time, that didn't work out because the demographic of people they were looking for was mostly from the sciences, which is more physics and mathematics and things like that. So I ended up doing a master's degree in risk management and investment analysis, which was sort of the in-between between investment banking and standard straight-up finance. So that served me well too. But ultimately after that, I was actually working in the University of Ulster at a period of time after I finished that master's on a temporary contract while I was trying to, you know, get that job that I wanted to do. And but unbeknownst to me, whenever I was 18 thinking I'll go and get all these qualifications and then come back to Derry and go boom, walk into a great job, and obviously the reality hits whenever you get back and realize that industry is not even in this city. So what do you do now? And I was lucky enough at the time, maybe it was like a combination of good timing and luck and what I had already done, but I eventually found myself sitting in front of a guy who owned a wealth management firm. And he, at the time, was looking for new staff as an administrator, you know, just a person to man the phones, actually. Not anything to do with becoming a financial advisor. It was just somebody that they wanted to man the phones and be able to speak and have some knowledge. So that's eventually how I got my start in the industry part. And then it just developed from there. So
I suppose after doing all the studying and everything else that you did, probably very frustrating when you come out of your studies.
Frustrating, I think it was naivety, to be honest with you, and that's me being very honest. Whenever you're at school, and you would have knew this too when you were at school, you know, there's a lot of conversation about what are you going to study, are you going to university, and my frame of mind was I am going to university no matter what. There was no, will we go to the tech, will we go and do a trade. That was just how I was conditioned, especially in a grammar school. And whenever I finished those degrees, especially the first one, and thought, you know, I'm not really that sure if I want to be an accountant. Maybe I should go and do something a bit more niche so that potentially I can set myself apart from the average graduate here in Northern Ireland or in England. And I thought, right, I'll do this. But then when I finished, I think there was frustration in the fact that I was more frustrated at myself for thinking that it was going to be that easy. Come out of uni and walk and do a great job and be all there. That's me. I've spent 4 years studying and now it's 40 years of good crack and making money and doing all this stuff. So there definitely was a level of frustration there. But I think it was, for me, definitely, the very age, very early stages of my 20s, a sort of slap in the face and a reality check that, you know, you have to pick your degrees and your career based on probability and where you're likely to get a job and if you're willing to move away to get that type of job. And that's all the things that weren't factored in whenever we were, you know, picking these degrees or these universities. So definitely a bit of frustration, but ultimately, touch wood, and I'll bless myself hypothetically that I got very lucky, and I'm very grateful for where I ended up, to be honest.
And I suppose looking at that thought process, and it's probably something that nobody really thinks about, is there going to be a career in what I'm studying here, and nobody taps you on the shoulder, or maybe your parents or you know, your guardians or whatever never thought of saying to you, well, look, you know, you're going down a path here that might not actually lead to very much. But before all of that, getting into that mindset of hard work, I suppose, I think I read somewhere you used to be pulling pints, first of all, too.
Well, at the end of the day, you know the crack, whenever you're 15 or 16 and you're a young man and you're trying to get out there, I wanted a job, obviously. I wanted to start making some money. And I think it was as soon as I got my national insurance number that I wanted to start working. But that was actually a job that I got further on down the line. Whenever I turned 16, I was working in, you know, retail shops like Next and River Island and things like that when I was 16. And then I eventually got into working in the bars and the restaurants. But ultimately, it was, again, sometimes I just have a bit of motivation that I didn't want to wait until I was 19 or wait until I got on the university to get a job. I just wanted to get out there. And to be honest with you, looking back on it, you know, working when you're that young, I sort of think forces you and the mindset where you have to be sociable. You can't shy away from things. And being in a bar especially, and you're meeting and seeing 100 different faces a day, eventually you start to become very comfortable and chatting and being sociable and approaching people and things like that. So it actually ended up being really good for me. Because at the time, and I don't know how other people feel about this, there's whenever I was younger, there was people that would have been scared to go and ask somebody a question, like, oh, just go and ask them for help or go and ask them this or that, whatever the context was. But I was like, nah, no bother, no problem. I'll do that. I'll go speak to them. I'll go and do that. Because I wasn't sort of scared to go and ask questions and be curious and put myself out there. And ultimately, it's exactly what I do now. It's just in a different industry. Relationship management. You manage relationships when you work in the hospitality industry. Give good customer service, make people feel good and give them what they want and satisfy them. And that's no different than your industry or my industry. You know, the main thing is the people. And I could be the rain man when it comes to mathematics or financial planning or terminology or jargon to do with financial products now, but that is not what matters. What matters is conveying information simply and so people can understand it, and giving them a good service and creating good relationships with them, because that's what it is. You know, it's relationships in business are long-term relationships. You don't just be transactional, do something for somebody and then move on. Well, it's much different than that, especially in an industry where you provide a service, not a product. So
yeah. And suppose if you just joined and watching this and you're wondering who we're talking to and what we're talking about, we're talking to Oran Coyle, who's a wealth manager, a financial planner as well, well known on TikTok and Facebook, and has really set the scene for getting financial advice in a simpler way. And a deep delving conversation with Oran, because Oran, suppose a lot of these things that people come to you about obviously are money, but as you were saying there, and I could see the way your enthusiasm get lit up when you started to talk about the relationship and the guidance and the advice, and that's not all about financial really, that's probably about caring first of all.
100%. At the end of the day, like, you know, a lot of people would have took financial advice from the bank, the high street banks in the past. And that was a really transactional relationship where you went into the bank and they seen that you had 100 grand or 500 grand or you had £20,000, whatever it may be, in your bank account for longer periods of time. And they say, you should really speak to the in-house financial advisor. Go and speak to them. They do whatever they need to do that day, that instance, when you sit down with them, and the business is done by the end of the day. But you might never hear from that person again unless you want to go and speak with them. But in our game, and in terms of wealth management, the relationship itself is much more of, you know, it's a much closer relationship than you would think, in terms of, yes, we give advice, and yes, we recommend all these products and how we can save people tax and how they can run their business better. But these people then start to trust you and come to you with other issues that don't even relate to financial planning at all. It might be, you know, I'm thinking about buying this house. What's the best way for me to do this? Should I do it? Is it appropriate? Do you know anybody that can help me with that? It's, you know, my son's planning on going to school in 5 years' time, the university. What's the best way for me to save so that I can make life easy for myself and my wife or whatever when the time comes? And albeit on the surface, it's very, I want to invest money. What can you do for me so I can save tax and grow it? It's all these other things that come along with that service because we provide an ongoing service. We don't just create transactions for people and then we don't see them again for 5 or 10 years. We have a commitment. They meet our clients annually at least.
Did that factor ever scare you in a way that you thought, Jesus, there's a lot more to this, you know, I've been pushed down a different alley and asking these particular questions, you know, you're really looking at someone's life as such and you're panning it out. Okay, it's in a financial aspect, but you know, it's a big responsibility. When did you feel that you were at the stage in your career that you could actually do that? And I know you could get you could get certified and everything else, but again, obviously you need to be very confident in doing things good.
I think you get to a stage where you start to realize that it's a bad assumption. They assume that everybody knows the very basics of managing your money and tax and things like that. And I'll be honest with you, sometimes in the very early years, whenever even I was just doing admin in the firm, I was thinking, how do people not know this stuff? Why do they not know this stuff? Is it because their families never discussed it, or their school never discussed it, or they never went seeking that information themselves? But then I started to sort of realize then, you know, number one, I'm happy enough to talk about this stuff and I understand it well enough to explain it to the layman, which is the main thing. But the second thing, and probably the more important thing part, was the firm that I am part of and the firm that I represent, which is a FTSE 100 firm. And you know, the confidence there comes from me knowing that I can give advice to people in a safe way, because we provide what we call an advice guarantee, which means when we provide advice, our parent company guarantees that it's appropriate, and they actually check our work. So they check our work periodically to make sure we're giving good advice, whereas an IFA or some other types of financial planners, they don't have that behind them. So I thought, you know, yes, I'm young. Yes, I'm in the industry 4 or 5 years, but I know that I have this person in this company on my shoulder that's going to support me at all times. And then that really drove me then to just go, you know what, I'm qualified. I've got degrees in the background that I never even needed that can help me, because you don't need those degrees to be a financial planner. You could just go straight from school and do the diploma and get qualified. And I thought, you know, I'm competent. I have good information. I can read company books. I can make suggestions. I'm a logical person and rational. I'm a rational person. So why should I not be doing my best to try and help people? And that's what it comes down to. That is it. And so I think probably the first year that you give advice, the first year you get your license, which for me was in 2019, you know, that's a transition stage from going between talking with people about what the firm's doing for them and being the person who is suggesting what they do. So I would say, you know, maybe 18 months after I got my license, I started to get fairly confident then. And then whenever you start doing a lot of business and all that sort of stuff. So it takes a bit of time, but you know, everybody's on a different lane, you know, so it could be 2 years, 6 months, 3 years, 5 years for somebody, but you know, I'm still learning. I'm still not going out there thinking I'm the bee's knees, but I'm trying my best to give good information. And as long as it's factual, you know, you can be confident as long as your information's factual.
Very good. So tell us, I suppose the odd video I do see and the odd bit of crack that you put, it's all good content, but when I seen you with, I think it was a couple of jugs one day, and I thought, yeah, that hits the point. You know, it's a bit of crack. This is the guy really thinking, how can I connect with someone on a simple, straightforward basis? And I thought, well, that is definitely one way. For me, it's as simple is always better, but maybe that's just me. But I just thought, and we had a conversation about creating that content. You must have a bit of crack with it as well.
Oh, definitely. I think the most important thing is that, you know, because I was talking about those assumptions that I was making, whenever you make those type of assumptions, I sort of thought, you know, if I try and remove all my assumptions and think, if I'm the person watching this video now, am I going to understand it? And if I say yes, I will understand it, then that makes good content. And then look, you know, financial advice isn't the sexiest topic out there. So you have to dress it up in a way that people actually want to watch it too, because, you know, the information is really valuable. We both know that. You know, it's saving tax and how to grow your money and all that sort of stuff. But the bottom line is, you know, people just don't want to see me sitting chatting at them all the time. So I'm trying to use these things, and only recently to get better at explaining it, if you know what I mean. And you get good feedback from them, and then you think, well, maybe I should be doing that a wee bit more. And then you sort of come up with a blend. So you have to be serious and professional, but you have to be able to, you know, infuse that element of playfulness so people can actually enjoy it as well while they're learning.
Yeah, it's striking a chord as well, I suppose, and obviously having those kind of understanding of what you're trying to get across, first of all, and what people might grasp as well. Do you have visions of you bringing in your granny and your wife now? Because congratulations, you're only newly married as well. So the content side of it is there a time where, you know, you get some insights that you thought, I never thought I'd get it from there, but I'm going to use that.
In terms of insights, what do you mean, Porrick?
Insights on content, more so on how to portray your information.
From the feedback that I get from the stuff that I put out there already.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, look, mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. The most effective way to put content out there and is short form, not long form. Like, short form podcasts are fantastic, but that is for, you know, for people who are genuinely interested in what you're talking about in the short form content only. So the short form content has to be quick and easy to understand, valuable information, and free is really important, and short, so they can watch it, digest it, and then they can go, right, well, you know, Porrick put that video out, that was very interesting, I want to know more about that, I'll go now and listen to one of his podcasts. That's what you want. It's all about inciting action, you know what I mean?
And that has really changed your sector, you think?
Social media, 100%. Mm. Look, see, before COVID, I was restricted. I was not allowed to use social media at all. And the timing just came where COVID happened. And from the top down at a FTSE 100 company, it's very hard to steer the ship because they can't effectively control the social media being put out there, the health processes and things like that, because, you know, I'm not allowed to solicit essentially online. I'm given free information so people can learn, but I'm not out there saying, do you want to invest, or do you have money that you want to invest with me? Because that's illegal. I can't do that. So it basically, I'm just trying to give people a bit of easy education so they can think, you know, maybe I should be doing that, or maybe that's something that I need to think more about. And then that ultimately gets them to come to me. But in terms of insights, you know straight away from what your audience wants to see, from how many views your videos are getting, the comments you're getting, the messages you're getting. And then you have to, if you ignore that, then nothing's going to change. So you have to sort of slowly go in that direction where people, you understand your own audience and what they are looking for. Because not everybody's going to come out public and say, look, go and do a video on X, Y, or Z, because they mightn't be confident enough to contact me. So you have to sort of try and gain insights yourself and learn as you go along. That's the main thing.
Have you been surprised of the level of interaction with it? Have you been surprised, suppose, I think you touched on it when you were doing the administration side of it. It was more so about, geez, I thought, you know, people know these simple things. Were you surprised there's so much that people didn't know, really?
Definitely. You know, it's very scary whenever you come across somebody who earns a lot of money, but they are, especially an employed people, a person who's employed. You know, you get people out there that are making 100 or 150 grand a year, but they're not paying money into a pension or the bare minimum. They don't know, should they be trying to leverage their pension more because their employer's going to give them more matching if they put money into their pension. But primarily, you'll come to people who run businesses and who are self-employed, who for the last 5 years have just been getting their books done and paying their taxes. I'm not thinking, is there a better way that I can do this? Can I minimize my tax? Can I avoid some of that tax? What can I do? And there's some people out there that are savvy, definitely. But you know what? The scales are definitely in the favor of people who are unaware. And it's not as such that they're not able to capitalize on the information. They just don't know that it's out there. And then I'm trying to give them the information so they go, geez, I didn't know you could do that. Maybe I should do that. And then ultimately that may end up in a conversation. And your industry is exactly the same. So I'm just trying to unturn the stones so that I can say, I've given you the information. You do with it what you will. You can decide that you want to take action based on that information or not. And that's okay. So that's what I think, definitely. But you know, financial education is a massive topic at the moment. Massive topic.
And scale it back to smaller information. And I love chatting about stuff like this because it really gets your mind thinking. But it was about maybe buying that new pair of shoes or changing the car every year. And if you popped it into an investment or whatever it might be, you know, something simple. I think, was it a fiver a week? It was maybe one of your posts. We just showed the incremental aspect of over 20 years or whatever. Tell us something, give us something good here, because I want to get back to the listeners about, look, if they put in a small little strategy and just decided to start really, really small, doesn't have to be big, you know, what could they do?
No, Paul, I'll say just before I do that, I'll say that there's a lot of people that are caught in the headlights when it comes to putting money away into stuff like this or saving money because they think that £5 or £10 a week or £20 or £50 a month is not significant. But over the long term, it really does make a huge difference. And I sometimes people feel like I'm attacking them when I come out with stuff like this, but it's really genuinely not for that. But you know, the simple answer is, like, if you are somebody who earns X amount of money and you have £200 a month of disposable income left after you spend all this money and you love your life, but then that £200 you're going and buying a new pair of shoes, or you're buying a chippy 3 nights a week, or you're being frivolous, essentially.
That's just what I'm small things.
So those small things would mean, if you could save £100 a month that you know you can save comfortably over a 12-month period, that's £1,200. Over a 10-year period, it's 12 grand. Over a 20-year period, it's 24 grand. But then if you are able to invest some of that money on top of that, then you can actually create compound growth over that period of time. And once, as you know, everybody gets to a sort of a certain standard of lifestyle or a certain standard of earnings, £100 a month might not be that much money. It is for some people. It isn't for other people. But no, it's a comfortable place where people could commit to something like that over the long term. And that literally could turn £1,200 a year, or 24 grand over a 10-year period, over a 20-year period, sorry, and the 50 grand or 60 grand if you invested over that same period of time. But the major thing is that if you keep money in the bank or you spend it, the effects of inflation is the real silent killer, as I call it, over the long term. And this is the same in the property game.
You've just hit the nail on the head there with something about inflation, and I suppose it wasn't apparent for a lot of things over the last number of years. It is really people that's going, Jesus, has that gone up so much in price? And for individuals who don't understand inflation, they probably have a better concept of it now because they've seen the loaf of bread going from 1 to 2, you know, two quite nearly over the last number of months. Explain that in a little bit more detail, Oren, and suppose as much detail as you possibly can, because it is, look, it's not the most hot topic to talk about, but understand it maybe. But again, give us something that we could think about, or something we could read to get a better understanding of it.
No bother. I'll use something simple. So say you have £1,000 today in the bank, and you think, right, if I went out today, I could buy a basket of goods for £1,000. Say it's or call it £100 you're shopping. This is what they base it on. This is a, it's CPI and inflation is usually based on a basket of goods. And it basically means that if this particular basket of goods, like bread and milk and butter and all the essentials, eggs, cost £100 this year, they buy. Next year, because of the economy and because of people earning more money or things like that, the price of those things goes up. And that basket now no longer costs £100. It costs £112. So it's £12 more than it was last year because the price of those things are inflating, right? And that could be to do with the costs of the people who you're buying the goods from, because they have to put the wages up with the people in their business, like Tesco's, because the interest rates go up and they have to pay more interest on the debts that that company has. So they have no choice but to put their prices up in order to make their business model work. But then that's passed on to the consumer, so you're buying it, right? So say the cost of that basket of goods goes up from £100 to £110 in a single year. So that's a rate of 10%. So if you had £100 in your bank account right now, the same time next year, if the price rises by 10%, then you can no longer buy that basket of goods. You need another £10. And so inflation measures the rate at which the value or the cost of things increases over time. And inflation's been around for a long time. And the government and the Bank of England want a long-term inflation rate of around between 2 and 3%. So they know things are going to go up in price, but they are trying to keep it at an expected level over the long run. But the big topic at the moment is because of all these things going vastly up in price, like energy and the cost of living, that the inflation rate has has got out of control, essentially. And now it's come into conversation. But essentially, inflation is the rising costs of a simple basket of goods over a period of time. So, and you can apply this to the property market too. If a property is 100 grand this year and inflation goes up by a few percent, then it's not going to be 100 grand next year. So if you have 100 grand in the bank to buy that property today, the same time next year, you won't have enough money to buy it. And that's a simple answer. Things will rise in price over time. And I don't want to make it any more complicated than that. But if you aren't doing anything with your money to offset the rise and that cost, then your money is losing value. Hypothetically losing value. So if the value of your house goes up from 100 grand to 120 grand in a year, and then another person comes along and says, I have 100 grand, I want to buy this house, then they can't buy it because the price has risen above what they have, because they haven't done anything with their money. They try and increase the value of it other than leave it lying in the bank. And so I done a video there a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, about the value of 100 grand over a period of time with inflation. And it said that, I think it was an inflation rate of maybe 10%. You can fact check it if you want. But the buying power after a period of time reduced from 100,000 down to 60,000 if the money, there was nothing done with the money at all. And so, you know, there's a balancing act there between, yes, I have money in the bank, it's my security. But at the same time, you're also losing the value of that money if you do nothing with it. And this leads on to another question is, why would I invest my money if the value of it can go down? But the matter of fact is, the matter of fact guarantee is that your money will lose value if you do nothing with it because of inflation. So it's either guarantee yourself loss of buying power in the short term by inflation, reducing the value of your money, or have a chance to offset that by investing your money or using high yield savings or leveraging your money to buy a property or whatever it may be. So there's a balancing act there between putting some of your money to work to offset the effects of inflation over time.
And looking at that, Oren, suppose the golden question that everyone's wondering is, when's that inflation aspect going to come under control? As we see, it's probably up over 10%. I know you'll tell me better, but it seems to be tapering around that.
Yeah.
Getting that under control, obviously it's energy costs that's driving it, other factors as well, bit of price gouging, let's be honest about it. So when do you feel that might come back? What cycle are we in?
Right, so here's the interesting thing. They say that the actual rate of inflation, they say, is between 10-11% or something since the start of COVID, right? But apparently, word on the street, and I haven't measured this nor have I fact-checked this, but the real rate of inflation is something short of 20 because of all these things that we've got going on around us, right? But the Bank of England came out with a report a few weeks ago. They say that they feel that they'll be able to reduce inflation back down to 3.9% by the end of this year, and that's a big assumption they make. But you can see already that the value, the cost of fuel, the cost of energy, that's all being capped, and the cost of fuel is coming down. So that will have a massive effect on it. And you know, there's a big topic around whether this whole invasion of Ukraine by Russia was the main driver of inflation around the world because of the energy supply and the holds on it. So look, it's one of those things where inflation can't stay at this rate for the long term. It's impossible because, you know, we're all feeling it. The wages aren't going up what they're supposed to be going up. And even the cost of shopping, you know, going to your local supermarket, even if it is one of the cheaper ones like Aldi or Lidl, people are still seeing and feeling there's a big price increase there. So, but the answer to your question without waffling, the simple answer is they feel that they're going to be able to reduce inflation, you know, quite immediately in the next 1 or 2 years. And the reason that they put the interest rates up was to try, and that's a monetary policy that they use to try and curb inflation. Because, you know, especially in the UK during COVID, the government was throwing money out of people and businesses, and that caused inflation because, you know, they're putting more money into the economy that was previously not there. So the economy expands, and there's more money. So you have to use more of that money in order to buy the thing that you want to buy, whereas the year before, that money supply wasn't there. And the easy way to think about that is that our country, if you consider our country a big bath, right, full of water, and the water represents the money supply in the country, and sometimes the government turn the tap on and start to fill the bath up with more water. And that's what we would call, or you could call, quantitative easing. When they put more money into the economy to help the economy stimulate itself, then eventually they turn the tap off, and then they try and sort it out. And then eventually they let some of the water out, they bring the money supply down in order to restabilize the economy. So the big question will be, in good time, and we've done this actually, they put the interest rates up the other day to 4.25%, a quarter point, which is a bit less than people expected. You know, they expected that the rates would be put up a half point, not a quarter point. And so that could signify the fact that the government, or the Bank of England, sorry, thinks, you know, things are getting under control a wee bit. We don't have to hike these rates as much as we need to hike them. And hopefully what the country will want to see and the economy will want to see is the rates coming down over the next while. Even if it's small amounts, that's okay, but that will give way to the less inflation. But essentially the reason they put up the interest rates, as you probably know, they put up interest rates that encourages people to save, because they're getting more interest on their savings, and it encourages people not to take on debt because the interest rates are high. They'll pay more money for the debt. And that means that they can basically manipulate you into spending less money because you're scared that you're going to pay more interest, especially on mortgages, over the long run. So that's what they're doing at the moment. And I think we're coming quite close to the end of that. You know, I wasn't around in the 90s when the interest rates are up in the double digits, and I definitely don't want to see it again because it's going to do some damage to the economy if it keeps up that way. So hopefully by the end of this year, Paddy, just deal with what the information is at the moment.
I'll have to come back to you on that one, you know. But no, some really good nuggets there, Oran. As I say, it's more of a financial class for us here than a podcast, but it's brilliant to, you know, just to get the understanding of all those different aspects, inflation, which is one, and those systems and how you can actually protect yourself investing, and how you can get a fire or 20 quid a week to create that. Suppose coming back to yourself, you know, starting off working in the bars in the city, were you always interested in business and entrepreneurship?
100%. I think that, you know, I always call it the fizz. You know, there's something out there that gives you the fizz. For some people it might be art, for some people it might be music, for some people it might be numbers or maths or money or whatever it may be. But I definitely, you know, always had that interest in business and finance. And it was, you know what, I'm telling you, it was because of my environment. You know, I was around people who ran businesses, and some people in my family had businesses, and I suppose it just became sort of a natural learning curve for me to be like, well, if they're doing it, why would I not do it? and then I got more interested in it. And obviously, when I studied accountancy, there was a business management attached to that. It was accountancy and business management. And so learned a bit more about businesses then. And I know it's a really weird one because business is such a broad term. You know that too. You know, everybody could say, I want to own a business, but there's a million and one things out there that could come underneath, you know. So I definitely always wanted to get involved in it in some way or form. And you know, that's obviously coming to fruition. But it's very difficult to plan that whenever you're 18 or 19, what you want to do. I just knew that I had that motivation to do something, but I just hadn't got it figured out yet, if that makes sense.
Is that something that as you look back, you're a little bit older now, you can understand, well, look, there is more to it than just rocking up and making a couple of sales. There's a little bit of strategy, there's a little bit of deep thinking and what the market needs. I suppose that's the most important thing. But from your point of view, what would be the first bit of guidance or advice you would get someone to think about if they were getting into business?
And the business specifically? Oh God.
Yeah.
Right.
What's your financial?
All right, okay, no problem. Well, the first thing that people should be thinking about, and it's common sense, but not many people apply, is number one, market research. You have to research what you're trying to get into, because if you don't, and then you go into a business where there's no need or no demand for it, then you're going to fall flat in your face. So if you know that there's a need for, or you're trying to carve out a need for what you are trying to put out there, and that those are two very different things, because, you know, everybody needs a barber, everybody needs an accountant, everybody needs a solicitor, all those types of things. So yes, you can join that industry and try and take your bit of the market share along with it, you know. But whenever you're trying to do something very new, like social media became one of those things in the last 10 years, carving out a niche in social media, digital agencies, and things like that. So you have to research the industry and see, is there really a need for me to provide this service? And what are people going to pay for it? What's the going rate? What can I charge? Whether I'm very good at what I do or not so good at what I do, I just do it. That's the first thing. And then after that, it's a strategy, obviously. You have to plan for what you're trying to do. What are you planning on doing in your first year? So you can get over the hurdle of the infamous most businesses failing its first year. And then as long as you can get past that and think, right, what do I need to do now over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years in order to keep this business running at a certain level, become profitable, start to sustain profitability. And then when you become profitable, then what do you do with the money? Do you have to siphon that out, or do you reinvest it in your business, or are you just looking to be a sole trader where you keep your business running at 50, 80, 100 grand a year and that's it? Do you want to expand? You know, and I think that's stuff that people learn as they go along, probably more on an entrepreneurial point of view. But there's a lot of people out there that do all that research, especially somebody like yourself and all the things that you do. You basically know from the get-go if it's a goer or it's not. You know if it's going to work or it's not, and you can apply that to business too. But you know, generally from my point of view, that's something that we would sort of step on then into the background several years after that's happened, when people get to the point where they are established and they are profitable and they've had a strategy, and we're trying to figure out then what can we help them with in terms of leveraging what they're already doing. And look, I am definitely not the first person that somebody should speak to when it comes to growing a business or business development or whatever. I try my best to think things through and come up with logic from all the businesses that we deal with, and we've seen we deal with on a regular basis. There's things that you can learn from most people, because it's not just about the business, it's about the person running it too. And that's that there's a very interesting dynamic between, is a business successful or not based on the person that's running it or the product or the service that it provides? You know, because it could be me and you in the same room providing the same service, but ultimately you might gel the other people better than I do. And does that mean that you get the business and not me? No, it's very difficult to understand that too. So there's a bit of L&D there, learning and development as you go along. So, but that's what I would say. Definitely market research, strategy, and then expansion. And that's probably two, three of the big things. And I'm hopefully you would agree with that. You might disagree, but
No, as I say, I'm always learning, always looking for different viewpoints on that, you know, and suppose it's the beautiful world of entrepreneurship, developing yourself, and suppose something I'm really passionate about is self-development and mindset development, and suppose it touches into that as well, and it gives you, it takes out a different level that you could achieve from yourself personally, and suppose obviously different people have different ways of doing things. I remember interviewing a guy who loves the cold baths and gets into them every day, and there's all that stuff going on as well, but there's definitely different strategies for that. Is there anything you think, Oren, that you do maybe a wee bit differently as well to keep yourself in check? You got married, which was the first thing.
do you know what I would say? I would say that up until now, I've always thought, like, maybe, you know, I'm doing the best I can, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But if you can genuinely say, I'm working hard and I'm doing the best I can, that eventually something will come good for you if it's worth coming good. You know, I think, you know, look, I don't get into cold baths. I don't do anything like that. I think that I am very disciplined on how I go about what I do, and I'm getting even more disciplined now. And I think that discipline and consistency definitely make a difference, because, you know, in my game especially, you run at a pace that's very high all the time, because, you know, there's people after you all the time, they get speaking to you, but you have other work to do, you have new people to see. But I would say discipline and consistency, but the main thing for me is just wanting it. If you want it, if you really genuinely want it, then it will happen. You have to, and I don't want to use the cliche words, but if you believe that you're going to do it, then it will happen. And that's what I think. You know, I'd say about 6 months ago, maybe last year at some point, I just sort of let go. I let go and thought, you know, I'm going to just really give it everything and see what happens. And as soon as I started to think of, I'm just going to put this video out there, I'm just going to click share and see what happens, I don't care. I don't care if people give me stick. I don't care if people don't like what I'm saying. But as long as I just start going, I'm going to start throwing stuff at the wall, see if it sticks. And whatever works, I'll do more of that. And genuinely letting go from an ego point of view has really helped me, because, you know, at the end of the day, you can't be the best at everything. I'm definitely not a perfectionist. You probably can hear that in the way I speak, but I just think that if you genuinely want it and you just let go and go, I'm going to go hard at this for a year. And then at the end of the year, you can go, right, I've been at this for a year, let's evaluate, is it worth it or not? And then you can make your decisions. And that's my point of view. I don't apply any rules, or I don't meditate. I try and be grateful, you know, vocally. I don't write down anything like that. I just try and get stuck in and serve people well. Serving people well, if you can help them, that's generally going to make a difference. That's what I think.
I like your style, Oren. Just get on with it.
Get on with it, right? Who says it? Shia LaBeouf. Just do it. Don't think. Just do. And I like to think of myself as a hammer. You know, if you put a nail in front of me, I'll hammer it. It's not going to be surgical, but I'll get the job. I'll get it done. And that's what I'm trying to do. Trying to get out of my own way, get stuff done. Try not to overthink anything. And the outcome is what it is. And, you know, there's a lot of financial planners out there, Park, that will say, I am only willing to deal with you if you have this amount of money, or I don't deal with people if they're not running a business at all. It's not the case for me. I will speak to anybody, genuinely anybody, that wants to speak to me. Because, you know, there's a big advocacy becomes a big part of your business whenever you help someone for no personal gain and they think, thank you very much for doing that. And then they'll go out and they'll advocate for you. And eventually somebody might come from that line that says, you know, I want to do business with you, I've heard good things about you. And that's music to my ears, because I don't genuinely think it's all about making money or doing this or doing that. If you can help people, the success and the money becomes a byproduct of helping people, you know.
And that's the thing, and that's the reason why you're on the Breadwinner podcast, Oren. You've been so good with your time, and as I say, you've changed the face of financially here, in the information, how it gets out across here, across the world as well, because you're getting over 213 views in one of your TikToks as well. Your channel, Instagram's getting up to 13,500. So people are really starting to get get really educated about what you're doing, and you're changing the face of that financial aspect. And look, you've been more than good with your time jumping on the we could call it the Financial Breadwinner Podcast, but the Breadwinner Podcast, it's been great. It's been very, very informational, more about the information from a financial point of view, but just a brilliant talk. We could do this again some other time. And I'm just going to let the listeners as well. This is Monday, and Oren has taken time out of his Sunday to chat to us as well. So, thanks very much, and congratulations on the big win as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on, Padraig. I really am grateful. It's an honour, honestly. I'll do whatever I can. I'll normally speak to anybody. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
How can people actually reach out to you and your contact details?
The best way to get me is on Instagram. And by the way, I'm just going to caveat this. There's a lot of fake accounts going around in my name at the moment, so be very careful. But my Instagram handle is Oren Coyle with two N's, financial advisor, all one word. And you'll see it on there. There's 10 or 20 fake accounts going around messaging people and all this sort of stuff at the moment. But that's the main place to get me. You can get me on the website, which is www.kmcwealthmanagement.co.uk, and you can find me on there. But no, most of my contact comes through Instagram. So,
yeah, 10 or 20 different fake accounts show you how popular Oren has got. Well, look, thanks, Oren, for joining us on the Breadwinner Podcast. This will, of course, be out very shortly indeed in all the different channels. We will be putting it out on our Facebook. It's out live now on our Facebook. We'll be putting it on YouTube as well, so you can reshare and re-listen to the golden nuggets that Oren Coyle, financial advisor, has been giving us today.
I hope today's podcast was useful. Please tag me over on all our social channels on Facebook and YouTube. Search the Breadwinners Podcast and click the like button on YouTube and subscribe, of course, and do connect on our Facebook channel as well. Please don't forget to leave a comment on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. But for myself, Padraig Hilferty, and the Breadwinner Podcast team, we'll speak to you soon.